So, we are looking at chapters 10 and 11, Canto 4 of the Srimad Bhagavatam. This one of the story of Dhruva Maharaj. And, you know, we have seen that Dhruva Maharaj was insulted. By his stepmother, Saruchi. He was then advised by his own mother, natural mother, to worship the Supreme Personality of Godhead because he felt insulted. He wanted he had some feelings of revenge. And he wanted to gain a kingdom even greater than his own father, Uttanapada, son of Swayambhuva Manu, grandson of Lord Brahma. So he wanted a kingdom which is, you know, practically greater even than Lord Brahma's. So he went to the forest as advised by his mother, and he worshipped the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And within 6 months, even though he was only a 5-year-old child, and by following the instructions of Narada Muni, he actually took darshan of the Supreme Lord who appeared before him, Vishnugada. The Lord awarded him the Dhruvaloka, the pole star, and told him that after the dissolution of this universe, the Dhruva Maharaj would go back to Godhead. And that the pole star, or Dhruvaloka, in the meantime, was in fact non-different from Svetadvipa in this material universe. Svetadvipa being the Lord's spiritual abode, Dharma. So, Dhruva Maharaj went back home. He was greeted by all his family members. Mm-hmm. Including his so Dhruva Maharaj, he was went back, and of course everyone was very, very happy to see Dhruva Maharaj. And even Saruchi, the stepmother who had insulted him, was, you know, now that she knew that he'd become a great devotee and got such blessings from the Lord, she was also crying to Dhruva Maharaj. So, Dhruva Maharaj, he felt somewhat ashamed of his material demands from the Lord. he realized that he missed the opportunity to have personal service of the Lord. And Maitreya Muni confirms in the Bhagavatam, the pure devotee is being always satisfied in serving at the lotus feet of the Lord, never asks the Lord for material prosperity. So, you know, that we discussed that at length, that even though Dhruva Maharaj didn't want material prosperity, he was still awarded that material prosperity. And then after considering himself wretched, King Uttanapada, so Dhruva's father, he was overwhelmed by the news of the return of Dhruva, and you know, he welcomed him home along with all others. So, Maitreya Muni then described the opulence of the capital city of Uttanapada, who, seeing the qualifications of Dhruva, decides to enthrone him as the next king and to leave for the forest. Now, in chapter 10, here's a quick summary and then we'll go through it a little bit. Maitreya describes Dhruva's wife and children and how his brother Uttama was killed while hunting by a yaksha. His stepmother Saruchi also died as predicted. So actually the Lord, you know, there was a prediction that his mother, you know, would pass away. She suffered the result of her offences to Dhruva Maharaj. And therefore she sort of had an untimely death. What happened was that Uttama was killed by hunting by a yaksha. His stepmother went into the forest being aggrieved, and she died while in the forest as well. So we'll hear a little bit more about that. So let's get into chapter 10. We'll have there's a big battle that goes on. I'll just read the summary. Hare Krishna. In grief and anger, Dhruva approached the city of the Yakshas, Alakapuri, and started to fight with the inhabitants. I don't know what I've done. I don't think I took it to them. I'll pause it. Govardhan's mystic potency. We were discussing that the other week, weren't we? The Dhruva Maharaj, he actually felt that the demigods may have bewildered his intelligence. You know, when the Lord appeared, instead of, you know, asking that he could be eternally engaged in the Lord's service, he asked for material name and fame and, you know, wealth and opulence and what have you. And he felt that the demigods had thwarted his intelligence just at that crucial moment at that, you know. And, you know, so the understanding is that we are somewhat controlled by, you know, different personalities within the universe. For different reasons, and also our mind is somewhat controlled by the amount of subject we eat at lunchtime, the amount of ghee in our brain also has an effect. But we're going to hear a little bit about how the yakshas actually bewildered Dhruva with their illusory tricks, you know. So let's read now chapter 10. I'll read it, so it doesn't matter if you don't have a book. We're going to go over there's a few specific points that we want to highlight as we go through this. And then later in this session, we do want to do some activity based upon these significant points. Specifically, some of the particularly interesting parts of Dhruva Maharaj's pastime is, you know, this anger that he displayed, both at the beginning when he was an immature devotee, and now, even though he's become a pure devotee of the Lord, we see in this chapter there's still some anger, you know. And so we want to sort of, and Prabhupada describes at certain points that what Dhruva Maharaj is doing is appropriate, and then at certain points there's some which is not appropriate. So we want to really look at that just because one is a pure devotee of the Lord, such as Dhruva Maharaj, does not mean that they may not at any stage be angry and vengeful, you know, against people who are somewhat disturbing elements in particular ways. And at the same time, there is still a limit to what's, proper. So, you know, it's a very, very good understanding of to get a clear picture of pure devotees of the Lord. You know, sometimes we have an airy, fairy, false, artificial understanding of what it means to be a pure devotee of the Lord. And this chapter on Dhruva Maharaj really clears that up. So, chapter 10. So, the great sage Maitreya said, "My dear Vidura, thereafter Dhruva Maharaj married the daughter of Prajapati Susumara, whose name was Brahmi, and two sons named Kalpa and Vatsara were born of her." So, he married, had two sons. That wife. Prabhupada notes, of course, that this all happened after his father had actually left for the forest. So his father left for the forest even before getting his son married. And Prabhupada mentions that Dhruva Maharaj was... to get his son Dhruva Maharaj married is not so important that it should take preference to his going away to the forest for self-realization. You know, that self-realization is above everything else. Yeah. So, you know, we follow our codes of duty within the Varnashram, but our principal activity is self-realization, God-realization, service to the Lord. That takes precedence, you know, over everything. That's an interesting point there. Okay, so Dhruva, he had another wife named Ila, who was the daughter of the demigod Vayu. And by her he begot a same name, Utkala, and a very beautiful daughter. So, Vayu, Hanuman was related, the son of Vayu. So therefore we see that Dhruva Dhruva married by his daughter. You'd imagine he'd have a nice relationship with Hanuman, wouldn't he? That'd be his son-in-law.
Brother-in-law.
Yeah. That sort of puts you in the picture where he fits in. Yeah. So, now, Dhruva Maharaj's younger brother, Uttama, who was still unmarried, once went on a hunting excursion and was killed by a powerful yaksha in the Himalayan mountains. Along with him, his mother Saruchi also followed the path of his son, and she died. So that was foretold that would happen, and that was a result of her offences to Dhruva. Even when he was, just a 5-year-old boy, before he actually took up devotional service properly. Now, when Dhruva heard of the killing of his brother Uttama by the Yakshas in the Himalayan mountains, Being overwhelmed with lamentation and anger, he got on his chariot and went out for victory over the city of Yakshas, Alakapuri. Now, this purport is one of the ones we want to keep in mind. So it's chapter 10, text number 5. Text number 4, sorry. It is related to one of the homework questions, so kick that one. Dhruva Maharaj is becoming angry, overwhelmed with grief and envious of the enemies was not incompatible with his position as a great devotee. So he was overwhelmed with grief. Envious of the enemies and angry, it is not incompatible with his being a great devotee.
Why does it say envious? I mean, isn't it because the Yaksha actually killed his brothers, or what? Well, anger, isn't it?
Well, it's envious that they had the power to be able to do that to his family.
There's a sense of envy, like, you know.
But isn't anger, like, natural? Like, I mean, not a good. Why there's such a thing as envy?
Well, for instance, you know, he could have admired how, you know, expert they are at killing people. You know, that's the opposite. Where, you know, there's some admiration or, you know, envy. Envy means that, you know, you don't want those people to enjoy that facility that they've just enjoyed, that they are enjoying or just enjoyed. You know, they're enjoying the satisfaction of, you know, killing people as they please. That made him envious. So I don't.
Be like, he's my brother. How can they kill my brother?
Sometimes there may be envy there. Well, let's put it this way. You know, when there's anger at something that's, you know, been done, there may be a tinge of envy, but then there may be greater or lesser degrees of envy that go along with that anger. You know, so the envy may be partly insignificant, or the envy may be quite, considerable. You know, it's a factor, it's a separate factor in itself, which can have its own, you know, measure, greater or smaller, so it's worth considering.
I mean, my confusion is, should we use the word envy everywhere then?
But that's what I'm saying, that, you know, sometimes you get angry and the measure of envy may be insignificant, not enough to mention. When it becomes quite considerable, we may mention it separately.
Also, if we mention it, this is, you know, if they mention it here, then we accept it.
If we say it
could be right, could be wrong, we're not so sure, but if they say it in here, then we accept that that's an envious.
It's a fact. If it's, you know, if we got it in the Bhagavad Gita, it means we should consider it as one of the qualities. Prabhupada wants us to consider that he is a pure devotee with envy, which, you know, anger, that's hard to understand, but envy is even harder to understand. So he's making sure, you know, and the Bhagavad Gita's making sure
that
we capture that point, that there is not just anger, but envy, you know. So
it's a bit, understandable,
of course. Even that's difficult, but, you know, envy is even harder to understand. So, you know, therefore, it's separately mentioned, you know. And grief. You know, he's overwhelmed with grief, which is also, you know, he's supposed to be on the spiritual platform, and above the I and my and conception of bodily relationships. And, you know, one time there's a lecture in the Prabhupada gives first canto, chapter 2, around about verse 4 or 5 or something like that. Might be verse 6. Verse 6 it is. He gave many lectures on that. But one of those lectures, at the end of it, an Indian gentleman stands up in the crowd and says, you know, that how is it that someone who's supposed to be, you know, an elevated devotee and associate of God and can be properly educated in the Bhagavad Gita by God himself, supposed to be well educated, and at the same time we see that such a person acts ridiculously. And Prabhupada says, by that you mean Arjun. Yes, yes, Arjun. You know, what is that, Prabhupada said? Oh, you know, that he hears the Bhagavad Gita, you know, I am not this body, you know, and et cetera, et cetera. And then when his son Abhimanyu is killed, he becomes overwhelmed with grief and you know, again, he's on the platform of just being overwhelmed by that. So Prabhupada went on to explain that. He says, actually, it's not possible for someone who's well educated to act ridiculously. And the man pressed that point, and Prabhupada said, no, your statement is ridiculous. You know. And says, you're speaking ridiculously, you know. So Prabhupada got quite angry at this person and made him look like a ridiculous fool in front of the whole audience. You know. And he was very angry that he was criticizing Arjuna. But he pointed out that Arjuna, a devotee, it's natural that they may temporarily be completely overwhelmed. You know, if someone's son dies, it's natural that someone can be overwhelmed with feelings of lamentation, grief. He said, but the difference is that Arjuna, he, after hearing the Bhagavad Gita, his consciousness was that, yes, I will fully surrender to Krishna. Then there was some, you know, his son was killed in the Bhagavad Gita while he was fighting for Krishna, his full surrender. He was overwhelmed with grief, and then he, you know, got over that, and then again he fought with Krishna with full surrender. So in the ultimate end, he remained a fully surrendered devotee, you know. So that the fact that he was overwhelmed with grief did not affect the fact that he was a fully surrendered devotee to Krishna and fought for Krishna. In other words, when his son died, he didn't say, that's it, all right? You know, I'm not surrendered anymore. That's too much. That's too much, you know. He remained a fully surrendered, even when his son died. You know, it was a big thing. So, you know, you wouldn't think, well, I've surrendered to Krishna, I'm fighting his battle, Krishna's, God's supposed to be protecting me, my own son dies. You know? So, but he remained surrendered. He fought. He continued fighting the battle. But the point Prabhupada was made was that it is perfectly natural for devotees. They feel the natural, you know, range of emotions as anyone else will. But they remain a surrendered soul. So here, Dhruva Maharaj, his brother was killed. So he feels towards the Yakshas envy, anger, and he's overwhelmed with grief. But Prabhupada, you know, this wonderful, very important statement in the Bhagavatam, because my experience over 35 years is that on these issues, there are too many misconceptions from devotees themselves. when they see a devotee, some reacting in a natural way to a situation, there may be some anger, there may be some intolerance, there may be some aggression. Acting in a natural way to a situation, but they remain, actually fixed up in their nice level of devotional service. I mean, it's a fact that sometimes devotees fall from the platform of devotional service and excessively, engage. That they may actually, some incidences may cause them to literally fall down to the material platform. But we shouldn't confuse that with devotees who are just having that natural reaction to a very serious situation which comes up in their life, and they remain fixed up in their platform devotional service. But too often you see the devotees having, some emotions come out because of very difficult circumstances, and they're almost labelled as, they're materially, affected on a material platform or what have you. And this is what we don't want. We don't want a society of robots, that we have to become robots. In order to be a pure devotee, you have to become insensitive, even to the most horrible things that may happen to one's family, oneself, other devotees or whatever. That's not what it means to be a pure devotee, to be, completely insensitive and incapable of showing a natural range of emotions,
Of that. That's what Prabhupada mentioned, isn't it? There was one person who was joking up here as well, if somebody attacks you, you shouldn't react, and you should... He said, that's not the test, you've got to defend yourself. And
yes.
I can't remember the Sanskrit term he used, but... that's what it means. If you're not the body, it means you don't react even if someone, stabs you or attacks you. Or to be more cruel, you move out naked. That's not possible.
That's right. Yeah, we shouldn't be out there. We shouldn't become artificial. So these are very significant pastimes, and these are some of the points I want you to keep in mind when we later on. We're going to do some activities related to this. This is one of them, so note that because you may want to refer back to it. So, chapter 10, page number 5. So we're just discussing that chapter 10, text number 4, in the purport there. Just have a quick read of that. Just to catch up to what we've just been discussing.
Maybe yeah. Just make that other point as well. Durva Maharaj is actually the brother-in-law of Hanuman.
Very
poor. Yeah. Durva Maharaj is the brother-in-law of Hanuman.
Where is it said, Prabhu?
Durva Maharaj is the brother-in-law of Hanuman because it says here that he married daughter of
Vayu. He married Vayu's daughter, Ila.
Vayu.
Vayu's daughter. Vayu's son of the wind god. Yeah. So they were making Hanuman and Ruth brother-in-law.
Yeah.
Bhima was son of Vayu. Yeah. So that would make him brother-in-law. Is it?
But wasn't there a story where Bhima actually Hanuman puts his style and Bhima tries to cross? As if they don't know each other.
Well, they may have different mothers. They may not have met. It's not like they all sit around the table eating shawarma together at 6 o'clock. They may not have met. They may meet in different pastimes. It's not like they're, because they're all family, that they have dinner together every day.
Something I would read.
Okay. So moving on. So Dhruva Maharaj's brother, Uttama, has gone to the forest and been killed by Yaksha. His mother went into the forest, she also died as well.
So just to summarize the point there, when you're saying that because we're not impersonalists, so because we're devotees, if the devotee feels the pain, but they don't become angry with Krishna, they continue their devotional service, it doesn't stop their devotional service, but increases their devotional service in some cases.
If a devotee is, you know, a mature devotee, then even when very, you know, extremely difficult situations happen, like one's wife, husband, parents, children, brother, sister dies, or you know, or something
or
very
killed,
you know, in an unfortunate way. As we discussed with Arjuna, his own son died in the war. Such devotees may become completely overwhelmed momentarily, you know, with grief, or if some circumstance is anger that someone has killed, you know, their relative. They may become envious, they may become vengeful, they may, you know, just the natural range of emotions may be there. In verse number 4, it's describing that this is, as Prabhupada says, it is not incompatible with his position as a great devotee. It's not incompatible. It's not like, oh gee, you know, he's supposed to be a great devotee, how can we see those qualities? It's not. It's natural. You know, it's a very important point. I consider it particularly important because I see so many times impersonalism coming out in devotees when situations happen, and they may be a devotee may be feeling some grief, or you know, they're overwhelmed by, you know, certain emotions that come up at that time.
Krishna lists out the 26 qualifications of 26 attributes of the devotee, right?
Yes.
And in that, he says patience, tolerance, you know,
yes,
self-control and all that.
Huh? Yes.
So when a person is self-controlled, probably, you know, anger is also to be controlled, isn't it? So
yes. So that's what's being, it's a good point, that's what's being drawn out, that at a certain point, as we'll see, Dhruva Maharaj's anger goes a little over the edge of being self-controlled. So a natural anger and grief, that's there. But a devotee always, you know, has some, you know, there's some temporary, they can be overwhelmed like that. But, you know, very soon they, you know, again compose themselves in their natural devotional state. You know, so that self-control, that tolerance, you know, perseverance is there. If they don't compose themselves after some time, that's what that verse is saying, you know, that they should. There should be some self-control. It should not go on endlessly. You know, 20 years later, you know, a devotee is still harbouring some emotions that perhaps should have been dealt with in the course of days, months, or perhaps a year, you know. So there has to be some self-control, some tolerance. So, you know, they're not incompatible, but it's not like within 2 seconds, you know, if someone comes into the temple, rapes someone's wife, you know, you can shed a tear for 2 seconds and then, you know, self-control. It's not going to happen, you know.
Yeah.
The person's going to feel,
yeah,
you know, some extreme, overwhelming emotions for some time, and that's natural. And people should not consider that, oh, that person might be a match of a devotee, look how disturbed they are by, you know, his wife by raping, you know, so disturbed. Should be more, it says, it should be, you know, Lord Chaitanya says we should be tolerant and, you know, humble. respectful to all of you. So, you know, we can't artificially follow. So, keep that point there in mind.
Again, to bring that in comparison, we have examples of Haridas Thakur when he was beaten in 22 marketplaces.
Mm.
He was praying that the Lord forgive those who were hitting him or beating him. And generally, Prabhupada says that a devotee tolerates all tribulations against himself, but he's intolerant when the Lord or another devotee is hurt.
Mm.
Is this the same point or is it a different point that you're making now?
Well, here, Dhruva Maharaj is actually the king. And he is responsible for protecting all the subjects of his kingdom, including his family. And therefore, a kshatriya, if a kshatriya, someone unnecessarily kills the subjects of his kingdom, and he doesn't become angry and you know, take some measures to curb the rascals, then what sort of a king is he?
What is surprising is Guru Maharaj knew that that's going to happen, that that is predicted, and Guru Maharaj was told about it. So knowing that that was destined for him.
Yeah.
I mean, if I was to grieve, I would grieve when the Lord would say that your brother will die like this.
Hmm.
So, oh Lord, can you protect him?
Well, let's put it. Yeah, let's.
But
put
that time Guru Maharaj was quiet. But now, when he, what is predicted that time is happening, that time he is grieving, or he feels reaction. Says, otherwise he should have known that Lord has said it, and that's going to happen. Even if not at that time, at least after coming to the kingdom, and he should have.
Was it the prediction that his brother would die or his mother would die?
Both.
Did he have the details of why and who, where and how and when? Or he just... So then the other thing is, what we're saying is temporarily, which is what the point is, that temporarily, even though he knew all those things, that he was overcome with those things. And this is a natural reaction. So that on one hand you say you grieve at the time, but still when it happens you'll still have some emotion.
That's what's really surprising.
But still, it's going to be a natural reaction. For instance, we all know we're going to die, everybody in this room. But if one of us dies, we'll feel some emotion.
Yeah.
Temporarily, we'll feel a little bit upset.
Yeah.
And that even we know that this is guaranteed for all of us.
If we look around, you know, they're all going to die, you know. You look at Svetas, you look at you, you look at me. But, you know, we're all sitting here smiling. You know, they just said we're all going to die.
That's
a prediction.
But
if someone suddenly drops dead now, then you'll actually, the emotion
will
come.
This will happen, because they did this to you, this will happen to your brother and to your mother.
Yeah.
Your stepmother.
Yeah.
So as a reaction is going to happen in a way that it is not at an appropriate time. So when it is not, he's very young, his brother. At that time it's going to happen, that time you feel more. And he knew it's going to happen.
Dhruva was, you know, appreciating the presence of the Lord. That was an overwhelming ecstasy that was there. And, you know, in the presence of the Lord, there's some sense of peacefulness.
Right, I agree.
You know, that you know, you don't tend to fly off the handle in front of God, you know, with your emotions or your intellect. So, you know, but it doesn't mean that Dhruva Maharaj may not have felt some, you know, pinching in the heart when he heard that. Right? So, although it's not necessarily stated, it doesn't mean that there was some, not some, you know, reaction there to some degree, but the full emotion when it actually happened is stated here. But that's also natural, you know, it's especially when you're talking to children, you probably said that to your own children, you know, that one day, you know, mum and dad won't be here, we'll leave our body and what have you, and then, you know, the little child, because you've got to explain to them sometimes, you know, and I've done this with all my children, you've got to explain to them about reincarnation, leaving your body, and then they look up at you with those open eyes, they go, does that mean you're going to die? And you say, yes. And, you know, you have to say it, and then, you know, oh, I don't want you to die, you know. They may feel like that, but 2 minutes later, they get over it. But there's something. But when you actually do leave your body, then you get the full, you know. Like, you know, you can just change the subject with them, give them a little, you know, lollipop, whatever, like that. A couple of minutes later, okay, there's something, but you can't give them a lollipop when the parents actually pass away. Then it's going to take a lot longer.
Also, there's one other point is that at the time when this happened, as you say, he's bewildered by being in front of Krishna for a start, so he doesn't. But that's not to say that this isn't the derived reaction from that. Because often when people die, you think, how's this wife? She didn't even cry at her husband's funeral.
Yeah.
3 months later, she'll break down and you think she's just been murdered.
That's right, yeah.
Because it's a delayed reaction.
There can be,
This can be the actual reaction from when he was told, but he doesn't actually realise it until it's actually happened.
That's another good point, yeah. That's a fact.
All right, so, I mean, she doesn't grieve
at
her husband's funeral and then she's murdered
3 months later. No, 3 months later she breaks down.
That's quite common.
And grieves 3 months later. It's like a delayed reaction. For instance, when my mother died, I did everything for her. There was no problem. I was amazed that I was perfect. I thought I'd rumble. I was perfect. 3 months later, I went up to New South Wales. I told a friend who was an ex-brother-in-law about it. As soon as that happened, I hit the deck and I had like a heart attack and all things happened.
Yeah.
3 months later, at the time I was perfect, I couldn't believe it. How come I'm not freaked out? 3 months later, I was on the floor.
So it does happen. I've seen it happen to others
as well. Yes, Maharaj is a king, so he has to react to
citizens. That's right.
His position has changed. The position of where he was in front of and where he wasn't. His position as king and not king. His position that now it's a reality, before it was the prospect. Lots of things change.
A lot of different factors there.
Circumstances.
You happy with that, Nirmala? A lot of different factors.
No,
but it's good. You know, it's good to have these discussions because then, you know, you get it gets you to, you know, really get a nice, clear, all-round picture of, you know, the Bhagavatam, and, you know, because these things otherwise, you know, how does that work? So it's good to, you know, meditate and discuss. That's our meditation is through the sound vibration, you know, hearing and chanting. That is our meditation, but we need to deeply absorb this.
During the discussion, a point has been raised. A king or a kshatriya, right? He protects his subjects.
Yes.
But on the contrary, we see that the king himself, you know, being a kshatriya, when he goes for hunting, he kills his own subjects, animals. You know. He's killing his own subjects, you know. Maybe sports, maybe eating, maybe enjoying.
Well, but also, I look at the other side of the coin too. Perhaps the subjects would prefer, if you're going to be killed because you're going to die anyway as an animal, would you prefer to be killed by a good king or just somebody?
No, that's not an attitude. Attitude is wrong. Because I'm an animal. No, that should not happen.
Shastra has given the thing that the king is given some lineage for hunting because he has to practice his skill to, as a king, to protect the citizens. So there's a certain amount. Like if, even if they do too much, that's not allowed. But there is a certain amount that they are allowed, that they have to go for hunting, but that is just to practice their skill and to keep their skills up to date.
And that's that animal's job to be there for him to practice that.
He does mention to him that, you know, being a Kshatriya, you've killed animals, but just ensure that you stick to your devotional service. Meaning the Kshatriyas do not escape the reactions, even though they kill animals. They allow people, they don't escape the reaction until they do. I guess it's the intention and within the limits that you stick to.
The kings do kill their subjects. Mm-hmm. So, for instance... that's a good point.
They don't escape the reaction, basically.
Yeah. I'm just continuing.
Sorry.
That same point that you're making, that kings, it comes up in here too, that, you know, there is killing, which is allowed, but if there's excesses, you know, there's reaction. And even the killing that they're allowed to do, there's still some reactions, you know, because it is killing, you know. So they have to, there's some contamination from killing. So they have to purify, you know. Therefore, we see even Balaram killed Ramahashan, you know, Parashuram killed the Chachus 21 times. He then had to, you know, in all cases, even Chachus and even, you know, Shaktivaishavatar killing, but they perform atonement to show that there is. You know, it's even when it's your duty and it's done properly, it's a contaminating sort of an activity to perform. The pandavas also, after the battle of Kurukshetra, you know, the different sacrifices and yajnas. So it is correct that, you know, even when it's done according to duty, you know, it's contaminating. There may be some reactions, therefore, they have to be very, very careful, even when they're doing it, when they should be doing it. You know. But chachas do have to kill their own citizens sometimes. Sometimes the citizens commit violence or different crimes where the penalty is death and they have to kill their own subjects. Then, you know, when the tigers and, you know, such start killing sages in the forest, then once they get a taste for blood, they also have to be, you know, killed like that. So they do sometimes have to kill. Therefore, the Chanaka Pandit says that, you know, the code that they is that for the sake of a family, one may sometimes have to sacrifice a member to save the whole family. Therefore, you see the Judah, when he was born, they said, kill him immediately. The sages came and they said, this person will destroy your whole dynasty, kill him. For the sake of a family, you may have to sacrifice a member. For the sake of, you know, a village or a community, you may have to sacrifice a family. You know, for the sake of the country, you may have to sacrifice a village. And for the sake of for the sake of your wife, you may have to sacrifice all your wealth. But for the sake of your soul, you should be prepared to sacrifice everything. And therefore, we saw here in this chapter that Uttanapada, even though he hadn't performed his duties to marry his son Dhruva. He just went to the forest, left everything, sacrificed everything for, you know, the sake of the soul. So these are the codes.
Can I just give up another point? The Mataji introduced before about the whipping in 22 marketplaces and how he tolerated it.
Mm.
But we also know that his pain wasn't that great, because Krishna tells him that he put his back over his back and he actually took the lashes for him, and that's how he was able to tolerate it. So like that. So,
I would say minimized. I would say that he still suffered. But certainly the Lord. You know,
but also if you cut his back to help him tolerate, that's also right. Help him to tolerate.
It did. It helped him to tolerate.
He was still crying. So the Lord is actually with him there, helping him like this. In this case, it seems like this whole episode here is actually for our benefit of how we can be bewildered and change, and how our position can change depending on those circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
How that, no matter how pure we are, we can still be affected by the natural.
Oh.
And that doesn't mean that they're not pure devotees and not pure devotees. That's not right to judge. That's what.
No, that's what we're saying.
That's what we're saying. That, you know, devotees had different services, and along with their services, they generally have a particular nature. Chhatris have a certain nature that they perform their services as pure devotees, they should not be considered. That they have fallen from the position of devotional service when we see certain emotions, you know, in them, that we, like anger, grief, you know, envy, like that. But at the same time, there are occasions where even, significant devotees, their emotions may exceed what they're supposed to. They should be a little bit more self-controlled. They should be more conscious of their position as a devotee that's well respected in the Vaishnava community. Therefore, Krishna said to Arjuna that, you know, in the battle of Kurukshetra, he was, you know, Arjuna, like, if you don't fight, like, you know, I'm your friend. What are people going to think of? You know, you're basically representing me. It's going to look, you're going to make me look bad. And you're my great devotee and you act badly, then people think my great devotee is not very high caliber. So that makes me, you know. So we have, you know, here that does come up. So let's move on. All these points will be covered a little bit more as we go on. So Dhruva went to the northern direction of the Himalayan range. And in a valley, he saw a city full of ghostly persons who were followers of Lord Shiva. Now, these yakshas are more or less devotees of Shiva. And by this indication, the yakshas may be taken to be the Himalayan tribes like the Tibetans. So, now, when Dhruva reached Alagapuri, their city, he blew his conch shell, and the wives of the yakshas become very frightened and full of anxiety. Then they were unable to tolerate this resounding vibration of Dhruva, and they came forth from the city with weapons and they attacked Dhruva. Now, Dhruva was a great charioteer and certainly a great bowman. He immediately began to kill them, simultaneously discharging arrows three at a time. So, the Yakshas concluded that, oh, this person can, you know, defeat us. But as heroes, they lauded the action of Dhruva. So here they admired, you know, and even praised, you know, whoa, this is a great, you know, warrior. This is a chachi. This is, you know, this is a real hero who's come to fight. So, you know, that's a real chachi spirit. That's a real good chachi spirit. This straightforward appreciation of an enemy's prowess is a characteristic of real chatriya spirit. So, still, just like serpents who cannot tolerate being trampled upon by anyone's feet, the yakshas, being intolerant of the prowess of Dhruva, threw twice as many arrows, six from each of their soldiers, and thus they very valiantly exhibited their prowess. So, they admired him, but they couldn't tolerate. You know. So it's sort of...
So again, it's envy.
It's that envy.
But it's still
he's better than us. Well, okay. But we can't tolerate him being better than us. It's cut him down.
But envy doesn't it kind of offset the envy if they are appreciated?
Yeah, they can. They're sort of side by side. They're side by side, you know. So there's appreciation, some envy, and some anger. You know, boy, he's really good, but we can't have that. You know, that's, we want to be better. So, okay. You know, it's like, for instance. Someone may have some great valuable things in their home, and they may, set up all sorts of, you know, they have watchdogs, and they have electric fences, and they have a safe, and they have, alarm system, and a thief comes in and steals their jewels, and they think, gee, he's good. You know, whoever stole those must be really good. But we're not going to let him get away with that, you see. And how dare he come into my house and steal my stuff, you know, he would punish, you see. So there's anger, there's envy. But there's a bit of admiration there, you know, he did it. It's like that. They're not incompatible. Some of these emotions. So, now the Yaksha soldiers, 130,000 strong against Dhruva, all greatly angry and desiring to defeat the wonderful activities of Dhruva. So with full strength they showered upon Dhruva, along with his chariot and charioteer. Various types of weapons, as all described there. A lot of fierce weapons coming at him. Dhruva was completely covered by an incessant shower of weapons, just as the mountain is covered by incessant rainfall. Again, another very nice point. So here we see, here is a devotee, someone who's protected by the Lord, and he's completely covered by, an incessant shower of weapons. You would think, no, but he's supposed to be protected by the Lord. How can that happen? But as we see here, this does not mean that he succumbed in the battle. The example of mountain peaks being covered by incessant rain is just suitable. When a mountain is covered by incessant rain, all dirty things are washed from the body of the mountain. Similarly, the incessant shower of arrows from the enemy gave Dhruva Maharaj new vigour to defeat them. In other words, whatever incompetency he might have had was washed away. So, you know, you can't see the devotees of the Lord, especially pure devotees, in the same materialistic terms that we see, you know, the circumstances that affect material people. But it doesn't mean that they won't be have to face the same circumstances that affect ordinary people. This is the dilemma, you know, that we have this false conception that, oh, pure devotee, he'll just walk through this earth and he'll walk on a bed of flowers or she, and nothing bad will ever happen to them because they're just completely protected by Krishna. You know, and they'll sleep in a beautiful bed and there'll be perfume coming in through the windows. Like this. That's the impression that people get, and therefore, you know, it's... No, they will be sometimes, you know, absolutely covered by calamities. Look at the Pandavas. The mark of being a devotee and not being a devotee is not that there's no calamities for devotees and there's calamities for materials. That's it. They'll both get calamities. But it's how the devotees always remain triumphant by the grace of the Lord even when the calamities are there. So, you know, a lot of misconceptions about devotees are cleared up in this pastime. Very, very nice. So, now the siddhas from the higher planetary systems, they're observing the fight from the sky. When they saw Dhruva covered by the incessant arrows of the enemy, they roared tumultuously, "The grandson of Manu Dhruva is now lost." They cried that Dhruva was just like the sun, and that now he had set within the ocean of the Yakshas. So again, they're very anxious about Dhruva, but Rupa Goswami says that not only is the devotee well protected by the Lord, but all the demigods and even ordinary men are anxious for his security and safety. So this is the point we're taking, that they're actually watching and they're thinking, oh no, you know, Dhruva is lost. So they're wanting to protect him. So this is a significant point. Not only the Lord, but actually the various demigods. Now, he appeared to merge in the ocean of the Yakshas just as the sun sets in the horizon. But the sun doesn't drown in the ocean. There's no difficulty for the sun. And although Dhruva appeared to have drowned in the ocean of the Yakshas, he actually had no difficulty. The sun will rise again. And so Dhruva Maharaj, you know, because he was in a fight, he'd expect some difficulty. But it doesn't mean that he was ultimately defeated. You know, we have to remember that Krishna describes in the Gita that my devotee, you know, will always be victorious. So the Yakshas being temporarily victorious exclaimed that they had conquered Dhruva. But in the meantime, Dhruva's chariot suddenly appeared, just as the sun suddenly appears from within a foggy mist. So we see here, you know, when the sun is covered by fog, the fog doesn't really cover the sun. You know, it can't actually cover the sun. But, you know, they're nice analogies there. But the sun is apparently in some difficulty. Never was it really in the beginning. So, sometimes we look at the life of a devotee and we see that they may actually face greater battles and obstacles than even the materialistic persons who are quite, you know, sinful or, you know, rascals. But the fact that they can face those obstacles and battles and remain somewhat untouched, just, you know, So their difficulty is somewhat apparent, like the difficulty of the sun setting in the ocean or being covered by the fire. It is apparent. From a materialistic view, a materialist may think, no, but they've had the difficulty. They've got difficulties. We've got difficulties. What's the difference? What's the use of being a devotee? What's the use of being a devotee? They've got problems, bigger problems than I got, you know. And they're talking about my karma, you know, I'm doing better than them. But the point is that the actual problems of a devotee, even though they are, it can be far more severe than the non-devotees' problems, in all respects, they're actually apparent difficulties.
Apparent consideration.
Because their situation is like the sun setting in the ocean. But the difficulties the non-devotees have are real difficulties. Okay, so now Dhruva he appeared from within the yakshas, kept firing away his bows and arrows incessantly, shattering all their different weapons. And piercing their shields and their bodies like thunderbolts released from the King of Heaven, Indra. And so we have a battlefield, you know, littered with the heads and arms and all the jewelry and what have you, which, you know, would usually become booty for the enemy. Very nice story, this one. I used to meditate on this story a lot, actually, when I used to go on Sankirtan. But, you know, I always used to meditate upon Dhruva because he was just so, you know, he really was just absolutely pummeled with, you know, from all sides with overwhelming odds and obstacles. And we see here even the illusory force of the yakshas. But, you know, he just stood firm and, you know, fought, and always with the grace of Krishna. And I tell you, sometimes going out on Sankirtan, you know, as a young devotee, especially in the early 80s, you know, you really felt that the whole world was against you sometimes.
Pretty much they were.
Pretty much they were, yeah. So, including, you know, sometimes your own family and friends and, you know,
and the police and the government and
yeah,
everybody.
The government, the police, and
the priests, everybody.
That's right. So, now the remaining yakshas who had not been killed. The ones that were not killed had their limbs cut to pieces, and they began to flee, just as elephants flee when defeated by a lion. So, Dhruva, so, you know, here, Dhruva is compared to a lion, you know, fighting elephants. A lion, of course, is much smaller than an elephant or a herd of elephants. My father used to always quote this to me. He would say that it's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog. It's not the size of the dog in the fight, it's the size of the fight in the dog. So, you know, a lion has much more fight in it than the elephants, and that's what wins the battle. So Dhruva was like that. He had a lot more fight in him So sometimes you see that. Now, Dhruva, seeing that not one of the opposing soldiers were left standing with proper weapons, he went to Alakapuri. But on the way, he had this apprehension. No one knows the plans of the mystic Yakshas. So they must have been famous for this mysticism. He was chatting with his charioteer. Then they heard a tremendous sound as if the whole ocean were there. And from the sky there was a dust storm coming from all directions. So the sky, you imagine everything just basically is blacked out with dense clouds, thunder, electric lightning, severe rainfall. There was also blood, mucus, pus, stool, urine, marrow falling heavily before Dhruva Maharaj. There were trunks of bodies falling from the sky. A great mountain became visible in the sky, and then from all directions there were hailstones, along with lances, clubs, swords, iron bludgeons, pieces of stone, serpents with angry eyes, vomiting fire, coming to devour him, along with groups of mad elephants, lions and tigers. Then, as if it were the time of dissolution of the whole world, the fierce sea with foaming waves and great roaring sounds came forward before him. So, the Yakshas, as described here, by nature, they're very heinous. And by their demoniac power of illusion, they can create many strange phenomena to frighten one who is less intelligent. Now, when the great sages heard that Dhruva was overpowered by the illusory mystic tricks of the demons, immediately they assembled to offer him auspicious encouragement. So, again, he was somewhat overpowered, just momentarily. So they said to him, they offered him this prayer: may the Supreme Personality of Godhead, known as Sangadanva, who relieves the distresses of his devotees — Sangadanva means, well, that's one who carries a bow, right? May he kill all your threatening enemies. The holy name of the Lord is as powerful as the Lord himself. Therefore, simply by chanting and hearing the holy name of the Lord, many men can be fully protected from fierce death without difficulty. Thus the devotee is saved. Very beautiful prayer there. Prabhupada mentions, so that prayer does contain the holy name of the Lord. Sangadanva. These prayers, are very potent. These are prayers that, if you do ever find yourself in a battlefield being attacked by Yakshas, you can always chant this mantra. chant that mantra. These mantras, in similar situations, these mantras are very potent. Just before I went to New South Wales, Sri Mary lost her keys, and we searched everywhere in the temple for them, the keys to the motorhome. Anyway, I rang Korma, and I said that it would be there half a day later because we can't find the keys in the motorhome. Not that we took the motorhome, but it took us so long searching them. He said, well, I have a mantra that was given to me by a devotee. It was actually the mantra that Hanuman used to find Sita when she was lost. And he said, I'll send it to you. Anyway, he didn't send it, but I didn't know, but he chanted it for me. very, very potent mantra. He said every time he's lost something, he's had a family. And anyway, he chanted it. That night, Srimurti had a dream that the keys were lying on the ground. Someone picked them up and found them, and which is what had happened. And then we'd taken off to Sydney, but when we got there, someone rang us and said they'd found, so they were, they'd found them, although we couldn't find them anywhere. So he chanted that mantra, and then the keys turned up. But, and then we came back, and we lost some other keys. And so we chanted the mantra again, we found them. So I'm going to have them tattooed on Srimurti's forehead. But,
Can we get a copy of that mantra?
Yeah. What is it there?
Yeah, she's learned it off by heart.
Because you're showing the mama mantra.
Yeah. But these mantras are very, very, very powerful. You may utilize them at some stage in your life. You don't know, but they have effect. But as Prabhupada mentions here, that simply by chanting the holy name of the Lord, one can surpass the ocean of death. So Dhruva Maharaj was certainly able to surpass the illusory magical feats of the yakshas, which for the time being disturbs his mind. And he says, by the grace of the Lord, if a devotee at the time of death can simply chant, he must mention it in the next chapter. He comes back.
What was that, sir?
About his chanting that mantra, Prabhupada mentions that, Lord Chaitanya has.
Yeah, it's the next chapter.
It's the next chapter. He refers to that. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Lord Chaitanya has left us the Maha Mantra, Sangha Pangastra, which means that's the weapon that Lord Chaitanya. Yeah. The holy name to the Lord, that's our weapon, especially the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, but the holy name is the Lord, that's our weapon.
Can I give you something about that, this holy name of the Lord being so powerful, I've even experienced it in a dream when people, I suppose, like yakshas or something, are attacking, because you have some nightmare sometimes, And strangely enough, I sort of looked at him and said, you realise I'm with Krishna. And I went, huh? And I said, you don't like that name, Hare Krishna. So I started chanting it, they all disappeared. This is in the dream.
That's right.
This is how powerful it is to think in the dream in his words.
Yeah, no, it's just that.
You see him as one of the yakshas or something like that?
Well, whatever the circumstances were, but it was quite like this sort of this stuff going on. And just remembering to chant the Maha Mantra changed it from a nightmare to everything was okay.
Yeah, it's fine.
They simply fled, just like.
Okay. Next chapter. So there's a couple of significant points there. Dhruva Maharaj hears the words of the sages. Performed Achamana, touched water, took up his arrow, made our Lord Narayan, and fixed it upon his bow. And that's where it mentions in that purport about the. In this age, Sango Pangastra. In this age, the Nayanastra, or weapon to drive away Maya, is a chain of the Hare Krishna mantra. So, as soon as Dhruva joined the Narayanastra arrow to his bow, the illusion created by the yakshas immediately vanquished, just as all material pains and pleasures are vanquished when one becomes fully cognizant of the self. So then we see how his Narayanastra arrows cut down the enemy. and they charged at him. It describes here that he delivered the yakshas to the planetary system which is situated above the sun globe and which is attainable only by the first class brahmacharis who have never discharged semen. So they go to Satchaloka, so he delivered them to Satchaloka.
The
yakshas? Yeah, well, they were killed by the Narayan Astra.
Oh,
yeah. And now, here it's described, killing, therefore, is not always bad. So this is answers your point, Surya. If the killing is done by the Supreme Lord or his devotee or in great sacrifices, it is for the benefit of the entity killed in that way. Material so-called violence is very insignificant in comparison to killing done by the Supreme or his devotee. Even when a king or the state government kills a person who is a murderer, that killing is for the benefit of the murderer, for thus he may become cleared of all sinful reactions. You know, similarly, the lion, the tigers and what have you that may be killed by the chatris in the course of their duty, they will derive some special benefit, you know, maybe being pushed through the evolutionary cycle to the human birth. You know, so they will get some special benefit, maybe. If it's in a proper religious, if it's done in a proper religious way.
Depends on the kshatriya, if he's a devotee or any of the prospects.
If he's performing his service according to religious principles, then there'll be some benefit. Now, Swami Vivekananda saw that his grandson Dhruva was killing so many of the yakshas, who were not actually offenders. Out of his great compassion, he approached Dhruva with great sages to give him good instruction. So here we get. So we've looked at text number 4 of the 10th chapter, where Prabhupada actually says that the anger, the envy, and the overwhelming grief, you know, that Dhruva experienced was not incompatible with his being a great devotee. Right, so it is not condemned. He hasn't done anything wrong to want to retaliate against the death of his brother and to be, you know, quite disturbed by it. So it has not affected his position as a pure devotee. Here, now, Uttanapada has stepped in and said, okay, Swami Vivekananda has said, at this point, those emotions, that anger is, you know, if he continues from this point, then it will go too far. It'll cross the line. And therefore we see how, ultimately, again, Krishna has protected his devotee through good instruction, at the crucial time. So, to protect that they don't fall down from their position. Now, you imagine here, of course, here's Dhruva Maharaj, he's rightfully performing his duties as a Kshatriya. His brother's been killed. And he's gone to, you know, punish the yakshas, and 130,000 of them have come at him to kill him. It's a massive, big battle. Now, you know, generally in the middle of a battle, you know, weapons are drawn and what have you. It's not like, you know, you say, oh, it's, 5:30, who can stop now? You know, there's a motion, there's an adrenaline, there's a, you know, a momentum, you know. So, you know, it's not out of the question that Dhruva may, you know, in that momentum, he's just still, he may just go a little further than what he should. it's not a, I would say, you know, it's not particularly questionable. You know, it's sort of like, you know, a situation where, you know, say your wife's pregnant, you jump in the car and you start rushing to the hospital, and then she says, you don't have to go that fast, you know. It's like, you know, you're sort of doing the right thing, but sometimes you get a little bit carried away, a little bit, you know.
Isn't it that on the battlefield that it was okay, but now he's gone beyond the battlefield, he's gone to the next place? So the battlefield is actually, he's spreading the battlefield instead of leaving it where it was. They're all down, and then he goes to the next place.
He went to Al Kapuri.
Yeah.
But I mean, the battle was actually where it was. That was all finished. They were all finished. Those people that attacked him, the 130,000. There wasn't any left standing. So that was the point where, okay, we put it away. But now it's gone further. Yeah.
Well, he went to see the city, but they attacked him from there also, right?
Oh, they re-attacked him.
Yeah.
But that's after he went.
Yeah, he went to the city and they attacked him again.
Oh, so had he not gone there,
he was thinking of going when that happened.
Yeah, he was thinking.
Yeah, not gone.
He was talking with his charioteer.
Yeah.
And
on his way there, he was actually
thinking that he's going to the beautiful city.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, then if you didn't now let me go have a. He didn't want to go and fight on the wall. He was thinking of going and
going
looking at the city.
Yeah.
But he was. He knew that they were had mystic powers at the area, so he was a little bit.
They may attack again with mystic powers.
Something may happen.
Yeah.
And so he was a little bit alert, and when this happened.
And then it did happen. Okay. Yeah. Okay. And it was quite a.
He was on his way when the storm came over him.
So. But the point is, there's a bit of a momentum of battle there. And, you know, they've thrown everything they could at him. He's one person, you know, him and his charioteer against, you know, hundreds of thousands.
Well, I was wondering how many of the 130,000 got killed by their own weapons, because there's only one person. They were all sharing weapons. I think friendly fire might have taken out a lot of them.
Well, there you go.
So it's after, but I'm just wondering at what point does Swayambhu Amalu come down? Because
he came down when he saw that, you know, because many of these personalities watch on from their vantage point.
But wasn't Dhruva actually defending himself because he wasn't being attacked afterwards? So
it says that Swayambhu saw that his grandson was killing so many yakshas who were not actually offenders. Out of his great compassion, he approached Dhruva with great sages to give him good instruction. Now, in the purport, it says, Dhruva Maharaj attacked Alakapuri, the city of the Yakshas, because his brother was killed by one of them. So, you know, Dhruva Maharaj, when it says he attacked Alakapuri, he was on the outskirts, you know, he was near the city, and they came out, and then there was a big, you know, attack. And then he wanted to go further into, you know, the city, and then there was a second battle. You know, so basically, he was in the precincts of Alakapuri city. It doesn't appear that he got right in there, but that's what it means. He attacked Alakapuri, you know. The city of the Yakshas, because his brother was killed by one of them. Actually, only one of the citizens, not all of them, was guilty of killing his brother Uttama. Now, Dhruva took a very serious step when his brother was killed by the Yakshas. War was declared and the fighting was going on. So he went there, he blew his conch shell, you know, and I'm here, you know, blowing this conch shell, you know, to declaration of war, basically. So that's what it means that he attacked the city. So. Now, this sometimes happened in present days also, for one man's fault, a whole state is sometimes attacked. Now, this kind of wholesale attack is not approved by Manu, the father and lawgiver of the human race. He therefore wanted to stop his grandson Dhruva from continuing to kill the Yaksha citizens who were not offenders. So he was certainly, he went there, he blew his conch shell, they all come out, I mean, he declared that he was come there to punish. It does appear that he was prepared to kill, you know, he was going to take vengeance on the whole city, so he was quite angry. So, you know, there was certainly on his part, he was prepared to just kill quite a few people to, you know, to get the satisfaction.
And sometimes this happens in a fight or something, and the fight, they've already defeated the person they're fighting with, but then they'll sort of start whacking people all around anybody because they can't just...
That's, there's a momentum, so... at this point, Swami Bhumani steps in. All right, Driva, let's have a little chat. And Vera says, so, now Manu says, please stop. It is not good to become unnecessarily angry. It is a path to hellish life. Now you are going beyond the limit by killing yakshas who are actually not offenders. So, even with the vast amount that he killed, we've got to consider they were attacking him as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, but... it appears that, you know, when 130,000 warriors were killed and then he's gone to the city, well then how many warriors are left? We don't know, but there's enough to throw some mystic powers and what have you. But when those mystic powers, you know, that's probably thrown up by the, you know, the Brahmana type yakshas or what have you, you know, if there are Brahmana yakshas, but you know, that type of, what do they call them, shaman. The priest, they'd have priests and what have you. So, you know, at this point, he's defeated the illusion. The soldiers are pretty much dead. You've sort of got the citizens in the city, right? And so at this point, they want the fighting to stop. So now you're going beyond the limit. Unnecessary anger. Adhiroshena means with unnecessary anger. So Swayambhuva came to protect him from further sinful action. From this we can understand killing is not bad when killing is done unnecessarily, or when an offenseless person is killed, such killing opens the path to hell. So Driva was saved from such a sinful action because he was a great devotee. Here Lord Manu prohibited Driva from killing the yakshas because only one of them was punishable for killing his brother, not all. So therefore, we said that Prabhupada explains, you know, modern warfare is very sinful, because that's what happens a lot. And so he describes that maintaining many slaughterhouses for killing innocent animals, you know, then they get the reaction of wholesale slaughter of their citizens. That is, you know, this sort of killing does not befit our family, he's saying, which is supposed to know the laws of religion and irreligion. So, you know, it's now putting a blemish on the whole family who's supposed to be the leader of religion. You know, this is a very interesting, as we described, this is an important point. When Krishna said to Arjuna, you know, practically you're not fighting, doing your religious duty, it puts a blemish on all the devotees. You know, it's like you're supposed to be my devotee, puts a blemish on me and all the devotees. Here, Driva, you know, put a blemish on the Lord and, you know, the whole family, those who are supposed to be upholding religion. And of course, you know, we have this in our own society, in ISKCON as well, that, you know, within the temple, the activities of certain devotees can put a blemish on the whole temple. You know, so these are considerations. You know, sometimes people ask if they could shave up, you know, shave their head, and you know, and we have to explain to them, well, you know, what are you going to be doing at, you know, because they're living out of the temple. And we have to explain to them, well, you know, you shave up, people see you as a devotee, but are all your activities above board? You can walk, you know, because people look at you and say, oh, you're sitting in the hotel drinking, you know, is that what devotees do? It puts a blemish on the whole movement. So, therefore, we don't shave people up unless they're, you know, come to a certain standard like that. So, hey, Krishna. And similarly, you know, we don't want to blemish the good name of their spiritual master. You know, they accept a disciple, and the disciple does something which is not good. It can blemish, you know, the spiritual master. So these are also considerations. Now, so he describes, you know, for one yaksha's offence, you shouldn't kill so many innocent people. One should not accept the body as the self and thus, like the animals, kill the bodies of others. This is especially forbidden for saintly persons. So especially for saintly persons, they're supposed to be non-violent. You know, and especially those who follow the path of devotional service to the Supreme Lord. You know? So then, we get into a philosophical discussion. So he describes it, you know, he's an extremely fortunate devotee that is already destined to go to the Lord. You know, as Prabhupada mentions, that every living entity is the residence of the Lord and can be considered a temple of the Lord. So the unnecessary killing of any living entity is not permitted. That's Prabhupada makes that point in the purport. And verse 12, because you are a pure devotee of the Lord is always thinking of you, and you are also recognized by all his confidential devotees. Your life is meant for exemplary behavior. I am therefore surprised why you have undertaken such an abominable task. Therefore, you know, Prabhupada would also caution the leaders of ISKCON, that especially the leaders, they have to, you know, above all, their example is supposed to be exemplary. So, it's difficult when a devotee does something that puts a blemish on the society of devotees, but it becomes more difficult when the leaders do. Because it has more an impact, more of a gives more of a bad name to ISKCON. So, you know, those in positions of where their behaviour is followed by many people have to be especially careful what they do.
Everyone there point out how wonderful it is that Prabhupada's behaviour was exemplary.
That's right. Yes.
It's what gave this whole movement its credibility.
It does. So for these different reasons, so then we have this verse which was quoted before. The Lord is very satisfied with the devotees when the devotee greets other people with tolerance, mercy, friendship and equality. And the essence of that, of course, is, you know, especially for innocent people, we have to be very merciful and tolerant with devotees. We make friendship and what have you like that. So here, Prabhupada is given in the very beginning that Dhruva Maharaj's actions of anger, envy, and being overwhelmed with grief is not incompatible. Now we're discussing where Manu has stepped in and said, okay, at this point there is there's a danger you may step over the line with this anger and what have you. At this point it's not looking, it won't look good. What you've done can be justified. What you're about to do cannot. So, therefore, because he's a pure devotee of the Lord has arranged for so many people to give good advice to prevent. And, of course, this is the importance of whether even someone is a great devotee of the Lord or in a high position, GBC, sannyasi, guru, one should never cut oneself off from good advice. Surround oneself with persons who, Prabhupada mentions, even in the time of Lord Ram, when Ram was ruling, he still accepted the advice of the Brahmanas. And Prabhupada mentions that actually any ruler, they are always surrounded by Brahmanas who give advice to them. And even Lord Brahma, God himself, he followed that. One who cuts himself off from that good advice, basically, when that is how the Lord protects one, because, sometimes, very powerful positions, they can cause one to become a little dizzy with the heights of, one's, greatness. But, that good advice from, various devotees and brahmanas and that's where the Lord protects the devotee, and to not have that, so sometimes if politicians or what have you, if they surround themselves with people who would just agree wholeheartedly, I want to do this, yes, and someone says, but isn't that a bit foolish? Right, you're out of the cabinet. This is what happened with, Kamsa and Ravana, that so many people tried to advise him. Don't you think that's a little bit foolish, Kamsa or Ravana? Oh, you're out. Get out. I don't never want to see you again. That's good advice is how we're protected. So, very, very important.
Prabhu, can I just say one thing there? Also, even Lord Chaitanya took the advice of the little boy about changing the name.
That's right, yes. Therefore, the sign of being a very elevated personality is not that, the sign that I'm so elevated is I don't have to listen to anyone else. The sign of being a very elevated devotee is that one is prepared to listen. And that's what Prabhupada said when he talks about Alexander the Great. He says, this is his greatness, he said, that when he captured the thief, and the thief was going to be punished. He said, you'll be punished, you'll have your hand chopped off, you stole a loaf of bread. The thief said, excuse me, sir, but you and I are, the same. You should also be punished. Well, what is that? Well, you're a bigger thief than I am. You go to countries and you pillage the whole country. I've just stolen a loaf of bread. And so Alexander said, actually, you're correct. And therefore he, excused him. Prabhupada said, that's his greatness. That was his greatness. Not that he was some great, powerful warrior, but that he actually listened to the advice, even of, a person. So, this is the sign of Driva Maharaj being a pure devotee of the Lord. He's not puffed up with you. Oh, I'm going back to Godhead. Don't tell me anything. I've seen God. Don't try and tell me anything. I don't. I know the judgment. Anyway, let's not go into it.
Lord Ramchandra used to take advice from monkeys and Vibhishan as well.
Exactly. That's a sign of greatness.
Yeah.
So,
to accept good advice, not any advice, but to accept good advice.
Now, I'll skip through it because I want to do some. I'm going to leave half an hour. Because we want to do our skits. To summarize some of these verses, you can read the purports at home, but Swami Vivekananda explains how ultimately everything that happens in this world ultimately is happening by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. When we turn around and we're going to, you know, blame this one and blame that, oh, you know, so-and-so killed my brother and, you know, this, that and the other, ultimately everything happens by the Supreme Lord. You know, it's his material energy, his modes of material nature. People are suffering the reactions to their own destiny, you know. So although everything is being done by the Lord, ultimately the Lord is not responsible for what's happening to them, because they're really suffering their own destiny according to the reactions of their own activities at that. But he has set it in place, just like a neutral person. So therefore, you know, basically killing Dhruva, you know, you're killing the yakshas, but you should be fixed in meditating upon the Lord's hand in everything, because ultimately he is the cause of all causes. And ultimately he's directing Dhruva. Just fix your mind upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is how you resolve this situation. One, you should understand he is the cause behind everything. You should see that. Two, you should understand that all living entities are part and parcel of him. You're inflicting energy upon those who are actually not different from the Lord, as part and parcel of his energy in so many different ways. And if you worship the Lord, you'll actually properly serve all living entities, including your brother who's passed away and this one and that one. They'll all be perfectly served because the Lord is the root of all creation. So in many different ways he explains to him, you just fix your mind in devotional service to the Lord. This is the real way to solve this. You don't have to go killing anymore like that. So that's a little bit of a summary there of many different philosophical points. And then a couple of, just in verse 27 and verse 31, we get a couple of other points about this Dhruva's anger and killing to meditate upon. And then we want to synthesize all of this.
I think he also says that by worshipping the Lord, then you'll be free from this concept of I and mine.
That's right, yeah. He's got to fix himself in the absolute position, yes.
And then that would help him be free from the grief of...
Yes. In so many different respects, just coming to that position. So it's you know, very nice instruction for us as devotees to take personally, that in the ultimate issue, the main thing that we should always be doing is fixing our mind upon the Supreme Lord and his pastimes, his holy name, and trying to serve him in devotional service. That is the main adjustment for everything that we face in this world. That is the main thing. You know? Not that we hide behind the holy name and don't perform our duties and you know, interact with people and what have you, but that should be the central point of, you know, all other things should... everything else we do will be properly done when that is firmly there. If we get too far away from our meditation upon the Lord and his absolute position as the cause of all causes, if we get too far away from our mood of serving him, and in that way serving all living entities and seeing everything related to him, other things that we do will not be in... you know, either be too much or too little, you know, and have some, you know, reactions that we don't want. So, he asks him, you surrender to that Supreme Lord, the ultimate goal of the progress of the world. Everyone, including the demigods, headed by Brahma, is working under his control, just as a bull prompted by a rope in its nose is controlled by its own owner. In this purport, Prabhupada mentions Dhruva was advised to stop fighting by his grandfather, who was concerned that Dhruva was adhering to a personal ambition to fight to annihilate the whole race of the Yakshas. So Manu, he was concerned, he's gone from avenging his father, it seems he's got some ambition to just annihilate this whole race, it's sort of gone on to something, it hasn't gone on to that, but it's about to, and therefore Manu seeks to eradicate this last tinge of false ambition in Dhruva by explaining the position of the supreme controller. Our ambition, it is the Lord who is the controller. We are not independent from what the Lord wants. You have a personal ambition which doesn't seem to be in relationship. It seems to be an independent ambition from what the actual supreme controller wants. So therefore there may be a tinge of false ambition like that. There's a nice little section here. I was going to read this at Gandharvika's memorial today, but they didn't leave any time. There's only a 10-minute memorial.
Yeah, I was
going to
speak as well.
I was going to read this part here about Gandharvika, that the Lord is death for the demons, but for devotees he is Amrita, eternal life. Devotees who render continuous service to the Lord have already attained immortality. For whatever they are doing in this life, they will continue to do in the next. They will simply change their material bodies for spiritual bodies. Unlike the demons, they no longer have to change material bodies. The Lord, therefore, is simultaneously death and immortality. He is death for the demons and immortality for the devotees. He is the ultimate goal of everyone because he is the cause of all causes. So Dhruva was advised to surrender unto him in all respects without keeping any personal ambition. Here the point is that he is the cause of everything, even the death of the devotees and the demons. He is the cause of everything that happens. Because he is the ultimate cause, you should surrender unto him, because nothing is going to happen without him being the cause of it. Don't have some other personal ambition, because unless if Krishna wants it won't happen like that. So that point there, and then in verse 31, the last point we look at before we synthesize it, he wants him to get over this concept of I and my, as Swetha was saying. And in verse 31, just consider what I've said to you, which will act as a medicinal treatment upon disease. Control your anger, for anger is the foremost enemy on the path of spiritual realization. I wish all good fortune for you. Please follow my instructions. Prabhupada says, Dhruva was a liberated soul, and actually he was not angry with anyone. But because he was the ruler, it was his duty to become angry for some time in order to keep law and order in the state. His brother Uttama was without fault, yet he was killed by one of the Yakshas. It was the duty of Dhruva to kill the offender, life for life, because Dhruva was a king. When the challenge came, Dhruva fought vehemently and punished the Yakshas sufficiently. But anger is such that if one increases it, it increases unlimitedly. So Prabhupada is summing everything up for us. In order that Dhruva Maharaja's kingly anger not exceed the limit, Manu was kind enough to check his grandson. Dhruva could understand the purpose of his grandfather and he immediately stopped fighting. That's a sign of a devotee, you know, that the tolerance and humility and self-control. Prabhupada mentions, by constant hearing about devotional service, one can check the force of anger, which is detrimental to the process of devotional service. Dhruva's becoming angry with the mistress was quite appropriate. Again, Prabhupada affirms the same point. Even after being chastised by Swayambhuva, he's saying that he's becoming angry with the miscreants was appropriate. So that's at the beginning and at the end he says that. There is a short story in this connection about a snake who became a devotee. He's a lovely story. And we'll get your comments, Mike. A snake who became a devotee upon the instruction of Radha, who instructed him not to bite anyone, bite anymore. Since ordinarily a snake's business is to faintly bite other living entities, as a devotee he was forbidden to do so. Unfortunately, people took advantage of this non-violence on the part of the snake, especially the children, who began to throw stones at him. He did not bite anyone, however, because it was the instruction of his spiritual master. After a while, when the snake met his spiritual master, Narada, he complained, "I've given up. I have given up the bad habit of biting innocent living entities, but they are mistreating me by throwing stones at me." Upon hearing this, the Radha Muni instructed him, "Don't bite, but do not forget to expand your hood, as if you were going to bite. Then they will go away." Similarly, a devotee is always non-violent. He is qualified with all good characteristics, but in the common world, when there is mischief made by others, he should not forget to become angry, at least for the time being, in order to drive away the miscreants. That's a nice, you know, defense of Dhruva, you know, that we see. So Dhruva was massively angry. "I'll kill the lot of yous. I'll wipe your whole race out." You know. They'll think twice about killing someone from his family or his, you know, kingdom. And especially because he's a devotee and he'll train all his kingdom up to be devotees. And they'll, and they're followers of Shiva. They'll think twice. They won't, you know. So it's like that Prabhupada is saying. So actually, Dhruva wasn't angry at anyone. You know, there was some anger. Manu was concerned. It appeared that he had some, you know, extra ambition. But Prabhupada is saying, ultimately, he wasn't angry. But he was making sure that as the king, you know, of a, you know, country of devotees, he's showing his hood, you know. You're done. Do you want to tell your little story? Or
no,
you can go. Alright. So, considering all of that, what I would like you to do is to form two groups.
Just one question. Yes. Yeah. So, Yakshas, what planet is this over there from?
It describes in chapter 10, Prabhupada says that. They appear to be tribes in the Himalayan mountains, like the Tibetans. Is it like the Tibetans?
But they're not from the earthly planet. They're from higher above or lower planet?
It
says that they were connected to Kubera, the treasurer.
From what I understand, some beings may reside in earthly planets, like the, you know, the Himalayas, what have you. But some beings have access to other, you know, higher planetary systems or lower planetary systems. You know, so, you know, for instance, some of these snake-like nagas, you know, who live in the lower planetary systems, sometimes, you know, have places here on Earth where they appear and they come up through the rivers and, you know, certain places. And, you know, there are instances in the Mahabharata where some of the devotees go into the rivers and they get captured by them. And, you know, but they, you know, they may have a connection to planetary systems lower or above as well, you know, to some degree. Especially here in Satyayuga, you know, there may be some, you know, ability to move between different Earth and, you know, other planetary systems and what have you. They're connected with Kavera as well. They're, what did you say? Was it the sons of Kavera or
It's mentioned because Manu mentions that Kuvera is going to get angry because
that's in the next chapter.
It's in this chapter. Manu's instructing Guru Maharaj.
Yes.
And he's saying you offended Kuvera because he mentions the connection.
That's right. My dear Dhruva, you thought that the Yakshas killed your brother and therefore you've killed great numbers of them. But this action, you have agitated the mind of Lord Shiva's brother Kuvera, who is the treasure of the demigods. Please note that your actions have been very disrespectful to Kuvera and Lord Shiva. They're worshippers of Lord Shiva. Kuvera's Shiva's brother. They've offended both. It says in their purport, verse 33, that they offended Kuvera because the Yakshas belonged to Kuvera's family. They were not ordinary persons. And thus they've been described as Punya Janam, or pious men. So they are part of Kuvera's family somehow. So they, you know, are this. And so then he was asked to pacify Kuvera. You know, Prabhupada mentioned one should maintain friendship with everyone and certainly with such exalted demigods like Kuvera. You know, our behaviour should be such that no one should become angry and thereby commit a wrong to individuals, families or society. That's generally what we take from this, Prabhupada is saying. But at the same time, because there are miscreants in this world who may sometimes unnecessarily harass us, sometimes a display of anger may be necessary. And which is what Dhruva did. And then when they thought, okay, we don't want to go any further than this, they gave him some advice, which he was immediately took, because as Prabhupada says, he wasn't actually, you know, it was a controlled anger. You know, for those who my father was a street fighter, so I know, but
what?
A street fighter. That's a long story. But they just get out in the street and they get in the fights. But they, you know, someone is considered, you know, people who lose their temper and go nuts are not as fearful as someone who's actually completely controlled in their anger. They can just release it as they please and withdraw it as they please. They're actually more to be feared than people who just sort of lose it.
They also direct it and focus it.
So that is very, it's very, yeah.
Instead
of
just spraying it everywhere.
That's right. Yeah, person who loses their control, their anger goes like this. My brother was like that. God rest his soul. He was my older brother, but he, you know, people would pick a fight with him, and he'd be swinging at me, I'll kill him, like this, you know, and they used to beat him up,
yeah.
And then I'd have to step in and fight them, even though I was his little brother, and, but, you know, it was a controlled anger, because, you know, but, you know, generally, Dhruva Maharaj here, it was actually quite a controlled anger. as a prophet, you know, he wasn't really angry, but he certainly displayed it. But even to his grandfather, Manu, you know, it appeared to be quite out of control. So, you know, perhaps that danger was there to some degree, and Krishna certainly made sure it wasn't going to be like that. He protected Judy, if that was the case. But Prabhupada seems to, you know, be making that point in that purport, that he was displaying sufficient anger to make sure that these miscreants didn't do what they did again. That was his duty, and therefore there's no fault. So, what I'd like you to do is to perform a skit. You can break into two groups.
the two groups have equal power or equal distribution of
assets?
Or should it be a bit lopsided?
I don't know. Do you want to have all women, all men, or do you want to have some, you know,
that's
for the sake of... men, all men, all women. Yeah,
we
do that.
Oh, that's okay. We can know our number.
Because yeah. Oh, that's good. So, Priya's going to join in with the ladies over here. Michael's going to join in with the men over there. If I don't like it, I'm going to get pretty angry. Alright, we'll pause this. Spend some, you know, a little bit of time. Let me get you to pause that. I want you to do a skit where...